think or ask. Amen.
good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls for at least a few minutes, till maybe about 20 minutes after the hour at least, so we can talk with our friend John Spring this evening about what's going on in Afghanistan. But before we get to that and another discussion of the Third World War, which is already underway, of course they haven't told the American people that, but we are involved in the Third World War, whether you know it, whether you believe it or not. But I just wanted to mention that, of course, remember Friday evening, our friend Dave Wegner is going to be speaking there at the Airport Inn, at the Ramada Airport Inn in Spokane at 7 o'clock in the evening. There's no charge to be there. Come, bring a friend. Now, he's going to be speaking tomorrow. He was speaking tonight in Portland. He'll be speaking Thursday in Bellingham, Washington, and then, of course, Friday evening at the Ramada Airport Inn. So hopefully there'll be a good turnout for him. David always has a great program and, of course, a lot of information and a lot of film clips and slides you won't see elsewhere. And he's reliable. He loves the Lord, and we're doing everything we can to help him. If you want to know about the rest of his tour, he's going to be in Kami, Idaho, and he's going to be in Salt Lake. Well, you can go ahead and look at our website, radioliberty.com, and we've actually posted David's itinerary there so you can follow him along. And if he's coming to an area where you're going to be or where you have friends, why, give them a call and let them know about it. Well, let's then get to our special guest this evening. John Spring is a geographer, and geographers study not only, of course, the lay of the land, but they discuss and study the politics and the various forces that work within a community, within a specific area. And John has been, of course, following the Middle East for many years. He has friends in the Middle East. And we were going to be talking this evening about what's really going on in Afghanistan. Now, you have to understand that in 1979, at the same time that Zbigniew Brzezinski toppled the Shah of Iran, because he did, under the Carter administration, we toppled the Shah and brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. And it was that same year, of course, that Saddam Hussein really came to a power in seized the government of Iraq, and many people believe that the CIA helped him to do that. I cannot document that, but many people believe that. And then, of course, it was in July of that year that the American government began to subsidize the Mujahideen, which were the Islamic warriors in Afghanistan. And of course, the purpose was to begin to destabilize the pro-Soviet government that had been elected there, so that the Russians would invade, and then we could have a nice war. And that's exactly what happened. And if you doubt that, a story as I've told it, that this possibly could have happened, this is actually documented in a number of books. And you go and you read my articles on this, and Brzezinski actually admitted on a television program in England that this was long-range planning. They knew exactly what was going to happen once we started funding the Mujahideen, and it was in December of 1979, then that the Russians invaded, and now we had our war. We could begin pushing the radical form of Islam. We could begin bringing Muslim warriors from all over the Muslim world to Afghanistan to fight in the war against the infidels. And then, of course, we could train them in terrorism. We could train them in warfare. And we could, of course, indoctrinate them in the Wahhabism, this radical form of Islam that justifies war against the infidels and, of course, dying for Allah. And all of these ideas, which are such an intimate part of Wahhabism, of course, the Saudis helped us, the Pakistanis helped us, but the CIA managed that war. And what people don't understand is the CIA are always managing wars, but of course we justified the war while we were fighting communism. And then, of course, in 1988, the war ended. In 1989, Al-Qaeda was formed and sending the Muslim warriors throughout the Muslim world to try to overthrow the illegitimate governments there that many of them we were keeping in power by financing the dictators and not allowing a free and open elections. And, of course, we not only funded Al-Qaeda, but we funded the Taliban. The Taliban began about 1990, and of course a lot of these were young men who were trained in Islamic schools in Afghanistan, where they were taught using American textbooks that pushed the radical form of Islam, dying for Allah, two bombs, three bullets and four rifles is how many weapons, the importance of killing the infidels, and we were actually pushing the violent form of Afghanistan in textbooks in Afghanistan all during the 1980s and presumably well into the 1990s, and even recently after we took over the country and they reestablished the schools, why USAID textbooks pushing this radical form of Islam are still being used in Afghanistan today. And if that seems beyond the pale, why would we spend, and actually the figure was $56 million on textbooks to push the radical form of Islam in Afghanistan? If you'd like to verify that, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And we'll be glad to send you a copy of the article out of the Washington Post that documents exactly what I've said. If you want the documentation for fact that Brzezinski intentionally precipitated the Afghan war, it actually comes from a book called Unholy Wars by John or James Cooley, a foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And if you want the documentation on that, we'll get this for you. You need to find out if this is really true. Of course, the book that covers this best would be a book called Dollars for Terror, written in 1999, pointing out that this whole radical Islamic movement that now threatens Western civilization was funded by Pakistan, the Saudi Arabia, and with the full support and knowledge of the American Central Intelligence Agency. It was all there written in 1999, and the fact that the American people don't understand where this radical form of Islam originated simply as a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. Now, actually, we do carry Dollars for Terror because we think it's such a vitally, vitally, vitally important book because it's the only book that will, written long before 9/11 that points out the CIA's involvement in this whole incredible scenario. Now, why would we do that? Well, how else were we going to get the Third World War going? I mean, you don't have to look at the history of what happened in Russia and in communism to know that from the very inception, why American industrialists, the American Federal Reserve Bank, high government officials were backing communism on one hand, and then, of course, saying, isn't it terrible? Gee, they're a terrible enemy. We've got to build up the American military to combat this threat from communism, which we've been financing all along. And now, of course, we have the same thing with the Islamic terrorist movement. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, we go into that. Well, right now we've got John on the line. He's waiting there patiently, so I'm going to keep quiet. John, why don't you tell our listeners what's going on in Afghanistan today?
Well, Dr. Stan, what is going on in Afghanistan is rather disappointing and rather alarming in many ways. But for me to make my case, I really need to go back a little bit into Afghanistan's earlier history, starting with about the mid-1960s. At that time, it was decided by the king to declare a constitutional monarchy in which a parliament, British-type government was established. A constitution was signed by many dignitaries within Afghanistan. And for all practical purposes, it was well on its way to becoming a free nation, which would be secular in terms of public laws. It would have the religious or Islamic laws within the home, basically. And this was a considerable contrast from most other nations of the Middle East that were predominantly Islamic of that time. So although we are seldom informed by the press or the news media that this was indeed a nation which attempted to have a representative type of government for the people and was very concerned with the needs of the people, and you had a king who was very benevolent in this respect. This is something that is completely omitted by and large. Now, things went along pretty well. We had organizations such as UNICEF, which helped to fund a series of highways being built by the Americans and the Russians throughout Afghanistan. Actually, the roads built by the Russians were superior in many qualities, but you have to understand that they were designed to withstand the weight of military tanks, which were used later on, of course, for the 1979 invasion.
But now, didn't we actually fund some of the highways over there?
Oh, yes, we did. Most of our highways, however, were built of asphalt, which was adequate, but the Soviets, of course, had intentions well in advance, several years in advance, to be able to support the tanks. Now, everything you've said, I believe, is entirely correct, but I would just like to emphasize one other aspect of the situation. Things went along fairly smoothly until one of the prime ministers demanded the ousting of the king. And when he came to power, he was killed. And then in 1978, the communists came to power within Afghanistan.
Now, how did they come to power? Were they elected, or how were they installed? This was a more or less a Soviet puppet government, wasn't it?
Yes, this was basically a coup that took place within Afghanistan in 1978.
All right, and how did they do this? Was it a military coup? Was it an election, or what?
Well, it was a military coup, basically. There was no election. Now, it's critical to mention this particular year because one of the Marxist leaders of that coup was a man by the name of Fahim. Now, the reason I mention this name is because within current Afghan politics, Fahim holds the title of defense minister.
Under the Karzai regime today,
yes.
The regime that we put in power has this man who is really part of the communist regime, and now he is the defense minister, probably the most powerful man in Afghanistan.
Yes.
So here we are in 1980, we go to war, we have this long, drawn-out, deadly, bloody war to defeat the communists, and now the new regime we put in, a communist, is really the power behind Karzai?
Yes, exactly. Karzai is really relatively powerless. The person who is really running the show is Fahim. And of course, you have a warlord by the name of Dostum, who was once one of the leaders working with the Soviets during the Afghan War. So here you have two people who are very much disliked by the former Afghan Mujahideen, and they are currently in very strong positions within the Afghan government.
Well, now, why would we, of course, we are the dominant force there, certainly militarily we're funding the whole thing. Why would we be funding a regime that was really controlled by people who were pro-Soviet? That doesn't make sense, if anything makes sense in that part of the world today.
Well, it doesn't, but you must understand that when the Bush administration came to power, they were looking for a, quote, easy solution, unquote. And, of course, Condoleezza Rice, with her background in Soviet affairs and Russian policies, and I believe she speaks Russian fluently, was able to make good on her contacts that she had established earlier with Moscow. And so, as a result, she made some contacts with some of the Central Asian republics, which were, for all basically purposes, still run by Marxists and Leninists. And they, in turn, supported what was referred to as the United Front, or the Northern Alliance, and gave a fairly easy victory against the Taliban forces. But, of course, we were never told of the ruthless activities of this group, just as we were never really told about the ruthlessness of the Taliban forces as well. Both of these groups were very ruthless, by the way.
And incidentally, of course, we had funded the Taliban, at least starting very early on, but certainly in 1994. You were aware of the fact we were funding and helping the Taliban, weren't you?
Yes, we were. But again, it's sort of a tragic situation in that we were relying primarily upon the Pakistanis at that time to carry out policy under the auspices of their ISI within war-torn Afghanistan. And we had very few personnel of our own supervising things over there. In fact, even most of our so-called CIA agents after the Afghan war were more or less relying upon the ISI agents of the Pakistani government.
And of course, the ISI, Pakistani intelligence, was really more or less a subordinate or subject to the CIA direction. Weren't we actually funding a lot of that?
We were funding practically all of it. But the thing was, there was no real set of checks and balances. Now, speaking of the CIA, Dr. Stan, very early, from the very onset, going back to 1979 when we were more or less drawing the Soviet forces to come in at that time when the Afghan government was controlled by the communists after a coup. One thing that people do not understand is that the CIA did not really have any intention of the Afghans being able to actually win a war against the Soviets. They just wanted to perpetuate a war that would more or less be an ongoing thing for decades, possibly. That was their original intent. They did not have any designs for a final victory against the Soviet Union by the Afghan Mujahideen, and as a result, they provided them with primarily inferior weapons for quite some time.
But eventually, of course, they gave them the Stinger missiles, which were able to bring down their helicopters and really,
yes,
of course, remove their real major offensive capacity. But how do we know that they never intended for the Afghans to win or the Mujahideen to win?
Well, there's been some documents. There has been a recent book written. I wish I had the title of it in front of me. I have not had a chance to read it. I think it was referred to as Charlie Wilson's War. The author of that book is George Crile, C-R-I-L-E, and it's published by the Atlantic Monthly Press, but I have not had a chance to review it myself. But my Afghan friends have reviewed it, and it seems to clarify that the CIA had really no intention of ever deploying Stinger surface-to-air missiles. This is something that came about a few years later, through the Reagan administration, after pressure was placed upon it through other sources.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, the CIA could also be putting out disinformation because they do very much control the media. They have their agents planted every place. And so don't you think that sometimes the CIA does put out disinformation and control the flow of information so that we believe what the CIA wants us to believe?
Of course they do, and they've been very effective at it.
What was the title of that book by George Crile?
Well, again, it's called Charlie Wilson's War.
And who is Charlie Wilson?
From what I understand, Charlie Wilson was a congressman who made it a point to spend a lot of time throughout the Middle East during that era of the late 70s and early 1980s. And supposedly was quite instrumental in influencing Washington to finally have the Stinger surface-to-air missiles deployed in Afghanistan.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to first be back in a few minutes to talk more about the Afghan War. What a great, great tragedy. The men fought and bravely and died, and of course, to defeat the communists, and now, of course, we have allowed the communists in key positions, and of course, this one leader that John is speaking of has his own military, many hundreds and hundreds of men, well-trained under arms. Of course, that is the private army that allows him to dominate the Kabul area, about the only area, of course, in all of Afghanistan where there's any law and order. So we created the Taliban, we financed the Taliban, we destroyed the Taliban, and now we brought the communists to power. What's wrong with this picture? We'll be right back here in just a moment, here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is John Spring, and we're talking about, of course, what's going on over in Afghanistan. And John is bringing out the point that certainly the Minister of Defense there is a longtime Soviet supporter, and of course other allies in key positions in the Karzai government, which we installed our Soviet supporters. What about this military force that is subservient to the to this defense minister? Who's paying for all that? Who trained the troops? Who supplied the military weapons for that? Do we have any idea?
Well, Dr. Stan, I believe that Fahim's small personal private army was trained by the Russians and former Soviets. However, the larger army has been is being trained, I think, primarily by U.S. forces. But one thing that we must call to the attention of our listening audience is the fact that every time a mission is designated or a target is designated, U.S. forces go along, assuming that they are helping to strengthen the federal government of Afghanistan, when in reality they are doing the bidding to a large extent for General Fahim's purposes. And this is why we need to be very concerned about what is going on. It is true that from a logical standpoint, we should be doing everything possible to support the central government of the Karzai regime. But unfortunately, Karzai himself is powerless, and as I stated earlier, General Fahim, who's the defense minister with very close ties to Russia, he's made several trips to Moscow since he came to power. He's basically running the show. And so every time a battalion of U.S. troops goes out on a mission, search and destroy, whatever it might be, they're really going on a mission at the behest of General Fahim.
Well, now, what about the drugs? My understanding is that, you know, of course, the Taliban had done away with most of the drugs in Afghanistan.
Well, that's not entirely true either, Dr. Stan, but go ahead.
Okay, and but now, of course, the drugs are flourishing again with the pro-Northern Alliance, pro-communist regime in power. Is that right?
Well, in spite of it, perhaps we should say, it's certainly going on. What has happened to a large extent, many Pakistani businessmen have gone into certain regions of Afghanistan, more or less given a monetary down payment in advance to many of the farmers, who in turn plant the opium crop, and when the poppy is ready to be harvested, the Pakistani businessmen come back and give the final payment and take the opium poppy along with them, or in some areas the heroin is processed right at the site.
Well, of course, with our satellite capacity to be able to watch every square inch of Afghanistan, you would think that we would know where the poppies were, and if we were really serious about controlling the certainly the growth and distribution of heroin, opium, why we would have we could stop it at any time, but we don't seem to be that interested in it, other than, of course, the war on terrorism here at home.
Well, regarding the opium poppy, we know practically where every hectare of opium poppy is being cultivated throughout Afghanistan. That's not the problem. The problem
I'm going to have to interrupt you. We'll be back here in just a moment to address that specific issue. Okay, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening, John Spring. And we were simply talking during the break about what's happening as far as the opium crops, which are flourishing in Afghanistan now that the Taliban have been destroyed, and that we know where all these crops are being grown, but of course we don't seem to be doing much about it. You want to pick up the story from there, John?
Well, Dr. Stan, one of the reasons why we're doing very little about it is because this is one of the few sources of revenue for the regional and central governments in Afghanistan at this time. This is one of the tragic situations. And you must understand that the opium poppy is a fairly durable crop which can be grown in semi-arid regions without irrigation, so they can practice what is referred to as dry farming, dependent upon marginal rainfall.
I mean, so it's cheaper for us to let them go ahead and grow the opium so we don't have to subsidize them. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, this is what they have been doing out of desperation, and at the same time they've been exploited by mainly Pakistani business people. But what we also need to understand is that there is an area referred to as the Helmand Valley, H-E-L-M-A-N-D, which is just west of Kandahar, and within that semi-arid region, if an irrigation project could be completed and renovated to some extent, that would supply the grains and truck farm crops for at least one-fifth of Afghan's population, which is now approximately 25 million. And that would be rather significant, but unfortunately, that is where the highest concentration of the opium poppy is currently being cultivated. So it's rather tragic that people are starving at the expense of the opium poppy for a quick cash profit at the expense of millions of Afghan people throughout the entire nation.
Well, I'm sorry, but what is the fact that people are starving? But I thought that this was creating a cash crop for them, and that was the justification for them allowing them, obviously we're allowing them to grow the heroin, and then of course we're just so concerned about the heroin crops, we've got to regulate every aspect of the American people and watch their bank accounts and make sure that they're not laundering money. And so what are you suggesting, that we are allowing this over there, at the same time we're regulating America with police state tactics because of our war on drugs?
Well, it's sort of hypocrisy. Over there, we are allowing basically the poppy to be grown on the rationale that this is bringing revenue to the people, but what we fail to understand is that cash does not necessarily translate into food for the people. A few farmers may get a little bit of a payment in advance, but in the long run, it's... diminishing returns.
I would certainly agree with you there. It's sort of like the justification of USAID, United States Agency for International Development, justifying the textbooks that were used in Afghan schools for a decade of pushing this radical form of Islam. And they said, well, after all, you know, the teachers wouldn't want to use it unless it had this whole idea about killing the infidels and killing anybody who's not a member of the Muslims. So that's why we put it in there. I wonder if that's really why we put that information into the textbooks of those young men, many of who joined the Taliban and were killed in the recent war. That's one justification for allowing the drugs to be grown. But is that the real reason? Or do we know?
Well, personally, Dr. Sen, I think there are other reasons.
Such as?
Well, I don't think we can afford to neglect the tentative pipeline route through western Afghanistan, leading from basically Turkmenistan into Pakistan to the south at an Arabian seaport for future marketing purposes.
Marketing now of the drugs you're speaking of, or what?
No, I'm speaking of a gas pipeline route which would go through the western portion of Afghanistan.
Well, no, but what does that have to do with the drugs, or is that a separate issue?
This is primarily a separate issue, but it is a key factor which caused us to go into Afghanistan at the time when we supposedly thought it was advantageous to do so.
In other words, under the guise of taking out Osama bin Laden, the real objective was to secure the rights for that pipeline. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. That was the primary concern, I believe.
And I think that there's a great deal of written about this long before 9/11, that, of course, we intended to go into Afghanistan. We needed an excuse, and, well, was there any better excuse at all? And I hate to say this, and I don't mean to sound crass, but was there a better excuse than the tragedy of what happened on September 11th? And now we go to war and secure that pipeline. We'll be right back here. And welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and let me just comment that there's a book called The Forbidden Truth, and of course it's written by a couple of French journalists, but we actually carry that book, and in that, why they describe a man named Niaz Niak, who was the Pakistani foreign minister, who was reading a meeting with the high officials of the State Department, and he, of course, was quoted as saying that in about July of 2001, about 2 months before the attack on the World Trade Center, the Americans were saying, either the Afghans will let us do what we want to and put in the pipeline. They have two choices. Either we pave their streets with gold, or we pave their streets with carpet bombs. They have the choice. And so the war was planned long before the September 11th attack. And, well, if it was planned ahead of time, why didn't we let the American people know that? If we were planning to attack Afghanistan and kill their people, does that change the complexion of what happened? And it doesn't justify what happened at all. In fact, we really have to ask ourselves, are we really being told the truth about what really did transpire on September 11th? We do know one thing, and that is that the administration is doing everything they can to block the current investigation that has just been formed, exactly as they did everything they could to block the previous investigation, refusing to release information because, well, national security. I'm assuming we don't want Mohammed Atta to find out what we knew ahead of time. So pick up the story there, John.
Well, you're correct in this area, Dr. Stan, in that well in advance, before 9/11 ever became an event, we had already initiated making plans with the Central Asian Republics just north of Afghanistan for deployment of U.S. troops and gaining cooperation with former Soviet military personnel and Russian military personnel for an invasion leading into Afghanistan.
Now, that was what in Uzbekistan. I know we were supporting the dictator there,
yes.
The Stalinist dictator. What other countries were we deploying our troops in, do you recall?
Well, we also had Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and Turkmenistan, as well as Uzbekistan.
Those are really tongue twisters, but we'll just
a lot
repeat
of stands.
Those again. They're all stands, but certainly there was Turkmenistan.
Yes.
And there was Kazakhstan.
Well, Kazakhstan is a little bit more remote from Afghanistan, but certainly there were interests of Kazakhstan, which was the largest of the former Soviet republics, with the exception of Russia itself.
So we were actually stationing troops there before, of course, September 11th, is what you're saying.
Very definitely. And, by the way, we did have troops into Kazakhstan at least a year in advance on various military maneuvers to familiarize themselves with that type of climate and topography.
And I think that were these a lot of special forces units that we were putting in there? Because, of course, we use the special forces throughout the world. I mean, highly trained killers, because that's what the military is, and especially the special forces. They're trained, they're highly disciplined, and they're trained, of course, to kill with their bare hands if need be, or with a knife, or of course, the use of weapons. And so many times, of course, they will go into these dictatorships, and they will either train the military there to protect the dictator, or they will actually protect the dictator themselves. And so why are we, a country so dedicated to a democracy, having our troops in protecting dictators? I never did understand that.
Well, in the case of Central Asia, you must understand that the Caspian Aral oil and gas reserves were considered to be quite substantial, and the only problem was that since this was a basically landlocked area, they had to decide on a series of pipeline routes to get these products to market, basically.
And one of them was, of course, down through Afghanistan.
Yes.
And it would go down through Turkmenistan, through Afghanistan, across Pakistan to the Arabian Sea?
Yes. And, of course, at that time, you may recall on several press reports, Dr. Condoleezza Rice was trying to villainize the leader of, or the governor of Herat, that would be Ismail Khan, and it is true that he did collect a lot of revenue from trade with neighboring Iran, But as a result, he was able to build up his province quite well, while the others have been rather chaotic and impoverished. He's been able to rebuild a good share of the infrastructure needed for potable water, roads, electricity, things that you need to basically exist. And
now, what specific country is this, and who's the leader?
Oh, this is Western Afghanistan, the province of Herat.
Herat, and who is the leader?
Well, the current leader is Ishmael Khan, K-H-A-N.
All right. So, of course, Afghanistan, you know, really is more or less ruled by warlords today. Now, could you just briefly comment on how valuable are the oil and natural gas resources of the Caspian Basin? Certainly one of my friends recently went to a meeting over in Paris. This was Mike Rupert, and he was told, oh, there really is not that much oil and natural gas there, which was totally different than anything I've been led to believe. And I wonder if he was being told the truth, since there were a number of people from the CFR there putting this conference on, and the whole idea of peak oil, all the readily available oil is gone. We're on the downhill slope. Sort of sounds like the Club of Rome back in 1971 and their idea of the limits of growth. My understanding is that they're coming up with new oil supplies all the time, and Caspian Basin is just rich with oil and natural gas, and don't even know how much there is there. What is your take on this? Because I know you're watching this very closely, John.
Well, Dr. Stan, first of all, it has been downplayed recently, as you've pointed out. The media is trying to say, well, the reserves have been overestimated. But from my findings, I would say, if anything, we do not yet know how vast this potential oil and gas reserve is. Conservatively speaking, I would say it's at least comparable to the reserves of Kuwait.
All right, fine. So what are you talking about, 60 million barrels somewhere in there?
Possibly more than that.
All right, we've got David calling here, and of course, there will have to be several pipelines, one for oil and the other for natural gas.
Well, now, that's a misconception also. It is possible to utilize a pipeline for many products.
But can you put them at the same time, or do you have to put alternately?
Well, they would have to generally be shipped alternately, but for a period of, let's say, 24 hours, you could be shipping natural gas, and then you could go to oil, crude oil, and in some cases even other liquefied products, such as ores.
Such as what?
Such as various types of ores in liquid content.
All right, well, let's go to David, who's calling us from Santa Cruz. David, do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, a quick comment and a question. Yeah, they sometimes put a ball in the pipeline between the different ingredients, and they may have four or five of them stacked up, and only a computer knows where that's at. And I used to repair and install those kind of computers.
Well, from my edification, I didn't know that. So tell me, how do you you run them through at different times? You have some divisions in there, or how would you run two or three different products through that pipeline?
Well, they just turn off one spigot and drop a ball in, and turn on another spigot, and then they keep track of where the ball's at, and sometimes they don't use one. They just have an interface one, as long as they're not incompatible.
But of course, the ball is basically to sort of separate the gas
from
the oil.
That's right. That's an irrelevant one. The thing that I was on this was during the time the Afghan was starting up, the war there was starting up, and there was big problems. I heard on the BBC that the corporation that was putting in the pipeline had the bids in and was reluctant to go ahead and put the pipeline in because of the instability in the country.
Yes.
And then they got the war going, and they took control of the place, and then they could put the pipeline in. But something went awry because that corporation was Enron, and I was wondering if you knew anything about that, and was that why Enron was taken down? I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you.
All right, fine. Thank you, David. Do you have any thoughts on that at all, John?
Well, Enron did have a lot of interest within Central Asia, within the Caspian Aral Basin itself. And yes, they did help finance several of the tentative or proposed pipelines, such as the one that was leading through Turkey and Azerbaijan, for example. Since the one in Afghanistan has not yet been constructed, I don't think Enron was that active in that project, although initially they did several studies on pipeline route proposals. I believe, however, that our listeners should know that one of the actual pipeline company that will construct the pipeline through Afghanistan, one of the heavy investors, from what I've heard, is George W. Bush Sr.
All right. Well, is that independently, or is that with Carlyle or something else? Some
that
other
would
major
be with
corporate?
The Carlyle Group.
The
yeah.
Carlyle Group is going to do it, and we've done some fascinating programs on Carlyle. Anybody who doesn't know what that is, well, of course, they are the an incredible a holding company. When I first heard about them a few years ago, they had $11 billion. Now they're up to $16. They made almost $1 billion with one individual public offering, an IPO. That's pretty good business. But then I suppose when you got George Herbert Walker Bush and the John Majors, former Prime Minister of Great Britain, and Frank Carlucci, former Secretary of Defense, why, it's really not too surprising that they managed to eke out a bare living.
Yes, and we should also mention that in addition to British Petroleum, Chevron Oil, formerly known as Standard Oil of California, has been very heavily involved in that region of the world, and of course Condoleezza Rice was formerly one of the directors of Chevron.
In fact, there used to be an oil tanker, it was known as the Condoleezza Rice, and but just before she got her job as the National Security Advisor, why, of course, the tanker disappeared. Well, it really didn't disappear. It just sailed out of the harbor in Angola as the Condoleezza Rice and came back with a different name. They really didn't, of course, want the American public to realize the close relationship between the National Security Advisor and Chevron Oil, especially when they'd been financing the Marxist government of Angola for so long. But anyway, of course, there are a number of pipelines going in over there. They're talking about building one over to China.
Yes.
They're talking about building one or two to the west. In fact, one of them was even supposed to go through Kosovo, wasn't it, somehow or other?
Yes, along the Danube corridor. And, of course, that was the main reason why so many innocent civilians in Belgrade and nearby Kosovo were bombed so heavily.
You mean it wasn't, we weren't there for idealistic reasons, we simply wanted to destroy the government so we could build a pipeline?
Yes, I know it sounds crazy, but this is the honest-to-goodness truth that was never reported in the media. All of this high-altitude bombing, which resulted in countless thousands of innocent civilians, people that looked very much like you and I, Dr. Stan, these people were obliterated from the earth because their leader would not go along with the conforming with the rest of the European community, basically. And he was the stumbling block for this corridor, which would extend to the Black Sea and then through the Transcaucasus to the Caspian Sea, where these oil reserves would be shipped or shipped from.
All right, and of course, eventually then, has that pipeline been built or is that under construction now?
I believe it's under construction, but you've heard very little ever mentioned about it. They're still in the process, of course, of rebuilding the infrastructure around Yugoslavia, the bridges that were destroyed.
And you mean that they're being rebuilt with American taxpayer money,
yeah.
And of course, many of the large corporations, I suppose, Halliburton and Bechtel, and I'm not saying that they're involved, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if for these international corporations that seem to have an inside track with our government. Was Soros involved in that somehow?
Was what involved?
George Soros.
I know that Chevron Oil had a very heavy vested interest in that whole situation. And unfortunately, a lot of our oil cartels have blood on their hands, Dr. Stan. That's not a pleasant thing to say, but many of our multinational corporations do. At the same time, we're led to believe that we were fighting for some other ideology, supposedly to enable the people in Kosovo to have some dignity in their lives, when in reality we had just destroyed the Serbians to the point where they no longer had an infrastructure to fight back with anymore.
Well, I think that the most important thing about Kosovo is that the listeners must understand that the Kosovo Liberation Movement was a radical Islamic movement. It was backed by Osama bin Laden. It was aimed at overthrowing a legitimate government of Serbia, if you can have a legitimate government under, a man like Milosevic. But there's no question at all that, this has been controlled by the Serbians, even though there are many Muslims there. So you have this radical Islamic Osama bin Laden finance group coming in. And who is financing? Why, the American CIA. And then now we've got a war going, and then, of course, we can talk about atrocities, and then, of course, we can justify the bombing. But it's really all about oil. And the same thing had happened over in Bosnia. I mean, certainly over in Bosnia, the Muslims there were being backed by the Al-Qaeda Muslims, Osama bin Laden, and we were working with them. So there's something very much wrong with what's going on, because I thought Osama bin Laden was our enemy, or as the truth that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But, of course, the average American can't see beyond the obvious. And for the documentation of at least the latter part of what I'm saying, there's a wonderful book. It's called Bin Laden, the Man Who Declared War Against America by Josef Bedansky. And I know you know that book. John, and he talks about how we had special arrangements and agreements with, of course, the Osama bin Laden radicals there in Bosnia, and we were favoring them and helping them. At the same time, supposedly, they were the ones who were responsible for the bombing of American facilities in Somalia and, of course, in Saudi Arabia. So nothing is as it appears to be.
Unfortunately, nothing does, Dr. Stan. It's very depressing when you consider that in Afghanistan, for example, when we go out, when I say we, I mean our armed forces go out on a mission, we are doing so to support General Fahim, and we do not know what his ulterior motives really are in destroying a hamlet or a community. For all we know, he may be looking for vengeance against former Mujahideen soldiers and leaders from the Afghan War. And so there is a great deal of resentment on the fact that the United States is backing the current Karzai regime, which in reality is the Fahim regime.
Which is the one we originally went to a war against back in 1980. So would that be a fair statement?
That would be a very accurate statement, Dr. Stan.
So there's something, what does it say? There's something rotten in Denmark. Maybe there's something rotten in Afghanistan. And it's about time the American people realize that wars are fought for far different reasons than the young men who fight and bleed and suffer and die are ever allowed to know. In fact, Major General Smedley Butler, who was certainly the most well-known Marine Corps officer in the 1930s, gave a speech, and we even have a copy of it. It's called War is a Racket. He said, I went all over the world fighting wars for American corporations. And I think it becomes quite, when the dust finally settles from our war in the Middle East, of course, we're told we're fighting the Islamic radicalism. And the fact that there really is Islamic radicalism, and it is growing. I mean, there more and more people within Pakistan are turning to Islamic radicalism, and the same is true in Turkey and in Egypt and in Saudi Arabia. But this is all because the American troops, the so-called crusaders, have returned to occupy Arab land. And,
yes,
of course, the same thing is happening. The people of Indonesia, Muslims, are actually turning to this radical. There was a form of religion. There was a recent poll, and I was just reading it earlier this evening, where they were polling people in in all of the Islamic countries, and Osama bin Laden is far more popular than our president. Now, this is something we really have to be concerned about. We don't want to wage a war against the entire Islamic world, and we can say, well, we're just against the radical Islamists, and yet, you know, is the more things we do, such as we're doing now, are only going to inflame the passions of these people, and we truly will have what Samuel Huntington described in his book, a crisis or a clash between civilizations. This is really what it's all about. And, of course, Western civilization going to war with the Muslim world, and this is the worst thing in the world we could possibly do, because it will have ramifications here in America for decades to come. But we are in World War III, and we're doing everything we can to inflame the passions of the average Muslim, so they will side with the radicals rather than with the moderates. This is my concern.
Yes, and we have to understand in Afghanistan, which, by the way, is not an Arab nation any more than neighboring Persia, or also known as Iran, or on the other side to the east, Pakistan. Those are not Arab nations. But the Afghans have been suffering for at least 25 years. We have to understand that an entire generation has grown up without any type of freedom as existed prior to the Soviet invasion and takeover in 1978 and 79, respectfully. That this entire generation has had very little formal, if any, education whatsoever.
Well, don't forget the education they got from the books we sent over there from USAID to train them in radical Islam.
Well, those books landed in the hands mainly of the Islamic schools, the madrasas located in Pakistan and to some extent even in India. And those were where those books were utilized the most, unfortunately. And those people came to Afghanistan as the Taliban, supporting the mullahs and warlords throughout various regions of Afghanistan.
In fact, the word for Taliban is really student. And
correct.
These were the people who were trained by Saudi Arabia and, I'm sure, by American textbooks in this radical form of Islam. And after being trained with our textbooks and with our funding, then, of course, we backed the Taliban movement right up until the year 2001, September. And then, of course, we went to war and we killed all these Taliban. And many of them, of course, were captured by the Northern Alliance we were funding and put into sealed trucks, these big semis. And, of course, they would died. Dozens of them died there. There was no air. There was no water.
Hundreds
of them died. And, of course, we finance that. And men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. Now, there are grave sites there with literally hundreds and hundreds of Taliban, have been just shoveled off into these big ditches by the people that we were financing then and we're still financing today. What's wrong with this picture, and why aren't the American people being told that we are responsible for what the people we employ do?
It's really frightening, Dr. Stan, because if the Americans knew firsthand what was going on, they would not want to have any part of the current policies over in Afghanistan. This is the tragedy of the whole situation, because America has always been a nation supposedly of ethics and fair play, and we are basically supporting a regime that is just as ruthless as Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler.
Right, or the Taliban. In fact, they still have a lot of the same Islamic law, not quite as severe, but still there. Let's go ahead and go to Mike quickly. Mike, a quick question. John's going to be back after the break, but about 9:20. But maybe we've got time for your question. Go ahead.
Well, I'm trying to figure out why UNICAL hasn't come into the discussion yet.
Well, of course, Karzai used to work for UNICAL, and you're absolutely right, of course.
And he was the chief negotiator between UNICAL and Taliban.
Isn't it interesting that, of course, that we would then select Karzai, who would work for UNICAL or negotiated for UNICAL, to be our leader of Afghanistan? Is that just a coincidence, or maybe, of course, this really does have to do with oil?
Yeah, maybe. And heroin.
Yep. Anything else?
That's all, thanks.
Okay, thank you so much, Mike.
Very good point.
Okay, fine. Okay, we've got about 2 or 3 minutes before we have to let you go, and then we'll have you back about 20 minutes after the hour, after we've checked and seen what's going on in Sacramento.
Well, Dr. Stan, I would just like to say very briefly that I hope the American people become aware of what we are doing in Afghanistan and what we are not doing. We have done very little to rebuild their infrastructure. The nation is still basically in shambles, and these people have suffered long enough. I think if the various factions knew that we really cared about them, they would be cooperative, but at the same time, they're very concerned about General Fahim and his private army and his national army.
But who's putting the money up for it? That's the question. It costs money to have a private army. Now, you think that's the Soviets?
I think it's the Russians to some extent, but of course there's revenue, I suppose, to be derived from the opium poppy. There's revenue to be derived from U.S. aid and other European nations that are giving a little bit of money. But we have to understand that most of the G8 nations have not come forward with their promises for aid to Afghanistan from that Tokyo summit held 2 years ago.
All right, fine. Well, firstly, the people there really are suffering. There's no, you know, there are a lot of the public utilities, you know, the water and the sewage and the electricity that we're so accustomed to in lots of areas just don't exist. The schools are not formed, the infrastructure is not formed. You really have more or less a lawless situation where you travel from one area to another and you pay homage and, of course, basically a fee to the warlord as you pass through his area. Is that a fairly accurate statement?
Yes, it is. And the roads are still in terrible condition throughout most of Afghanistan. The only section that's been improved is from Iran to Herat, with the cooperation of the Iranian government.
All right, fine. Well, then what can be done to help these people? Because, you know, we have, of course, been involved there for really 23 long years now. And I don't think that the Afghan people are much better off than when we started 23 years ago. In some respects, an awful lot of them have died in the intervening years in the various wars that we have manipulated, in the war with the Soviets, and then, of course, the war with the Taliban, and now, of course, the war between the warlords.
Well, I would hope, Dr. Stan, that every listener would contact his or her congressman or woman and declare how outraged they are about the situation, about the fact that we basically are keeping a Marxist-Leninist in power. And
that's General Fahim, of course.
That's General Fahim. And, of course, Karzai is very weak. When I come back, we could discuss the possibility of the king returning for a brief period of time to rule the entire nation, because he's about the only one that's respected throughout all of Afghanistan right now.
I think that's an excellent, of course, comment, and I think that you have to have somebody for the people to rally behind you. I think he was an honest man, and there are certainly many, many people who feel that he would be the ideal ruler. So why didn't we bring in him? Well, of course, Karzai, of course, was a agent or had worked for UNICAL, and maybe we were more interested in the pipeline than we pretty were about the stability and the welfare of the Afghan people. Anyway, we put Karzai in, we're keeping Karzai in, and of course Fahim is the force behind that. John, thanks so much. We'll be calling in about 20 minutes.
Very good.
Bye-bye.
Thank you again.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. And so we'll be right back here in just a few moments with our special guest, John Spring. But of course, right now we're going to take a break, and then we'll be talking to Randy Thomas and to our good friend Brad Diggins. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we're hoping very, very soon to have on the line with us from the Sacramento area of California, Randy Thomason. And Randy is a very nice young man. I've known him for, close to 10 years now. He used to work for Capital Resources, and now, of course, he's off on his own as a lobbying force in the Sacramento area, trying to bring some sanity out of the incredible things that are happening up there. And, of course, there is a real, of course, effort to use the legislative process to destroy the moral fabric of our society, and to do in California what was done to Sodom and Gomorrah almost 4,000 years ago. And, you know, there's nothing new about homosexuality. It's been around since the beginning of time. And certainly it was Sodom and Gomorrah were there at the time that that Abraham was living in the mountains, and then in that great plain adjacent to what today we could refer to as the Dead Sea. And then, of course, we know, of course, at the time of St. Paul, homosexuality was prevalent. Certainly at the time of ancient Greece, about 350, 400 years before birth of Christ, why homosexuality was prevalent. It was prevalent in ancient Rome, and of course, according to Gibbon, it was one of the major factors in the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And of course, here in Sacramento, why legislation is being passed to encourage this lifestyle, to force it into the Boy Scouts, to force it into our schools, and of course, in the process, to change America forever. Randy, how are you doing? Randy Thomason, are you there? Oh, I guess I have to push the button. Randy Thomason, are you there?
Good, Dr. Stan. You've reached me in Los Angeles this evening.
All right, fine. Well, I know that you're on the front lines and certainly doing everything you can to try to block the passage of AB 205. And is there any chance that Governor Davis will just simply veto that piece of legislation?
Thankfully, the answer is yes. This governor is in a terrible situation for his political future. Today's field poll, which is one of the most unreliable polls that I know of, actually was fairly conclusive in saying that a strong majority of Californians disapprove of Governor Gray Davis's job. They're opposed to his overall job performance. They oppose his half-cent sales tax idea. They opposed what he did to triple the car tax. And so today's poll means that the people are catching up with the truth. We've got a pretty bad government up in Sacramento, California's state capital.
But, of course, the news today was that, you know, a lot of the people who collected the signatures for Daryl Issa weren't residents of the state of California and, you know, weren't qualified to collect the signatures. Is there any truth to that, or is that simply a smokescreen?
Well, there's a claim that the signatures were improperly gathered. I believe that the recall organizers knew the law well, and they did it properly. And what we're seeing now is nothing that should surprise us, as Al Gore specialized on thinking that pregnant chads and hanging chads should be counted as votes in the Florida presidential primary election. I think that you're going to see Gray Davis's attorneys just pull out the stops. He's very close to the trial lawyers, and that's raising the cost of medical insurance everywhere. And he's going to just pursue this in court as much as possible. I hope that a judge dismisses these lawsuits as frivolous, and we have a certification of the recall within a week.
All right, fine. Well, this things are really moving at a fairly good rate, huh?
Well, when you look at what has happened, it's a historic recall effort. 1.6 million signatures collected from California registered voters. This is truly historic. There have been 31 attempts to recall a California governor. None has gone this far. And so what we're looking at is likely to see a recall election on the California ballot in October or November of this year. Now, something that's very interesting from the field poll is that people are just going to get madder and madder. In September, California automobile owners, which is virtually everyone, is going to see their car tax tripled. They'll get that bad news in September, and it will just probably make them go, who is doing this? Well, Steve Wetzley, the state controller, partnered with Governor Gray Davis to do this dirty deed. They didn't have to. They should have cut wasteful government spending. They're raising taxes on your car instead. And the voters are going to look for who to blame. So I think Governor Gray Davis's chances of surviving this recall just go down and down and down.
All right, fine. Well, it's certainly it's going to be very interesting as this this plays out because this will have a profound impact upon what sort of the state we live on in the months and years to come. Now, is anything being done as far as to block this effort to balance the budget by borrowing from our children and our grandchildren? In other words, what they're trying to do is pass bond issues and, of course, borrow the money, but that money's going to have to be paid back with interest, which means we'll be paying back twice as much if they were to do what right today. Is anybody talking about that? And how much
well,
are they trying to borrow?
You and I are talking about it. There's about $11 billion that would be this putting off the debt or paying down the debt. The Democrats want to pass a half-cent sales tax and fund this debt payment. The Republicans have some other maneuvers, which is not involving taxes, and I don't know all of the details of that, but you're absolutely right. Bonds should be thought of as bondage, because paying a simple tax is cheaper than a bond. And so this is not free money. Again, we need to see the size of government cut drastically in California. And again, I think this is a good standoff happening in Sacramento. The state budget is 2 weeks overdue. It can stay overdue as long as possible, in my opinion, because we need a good state budget, one that does not raise taxes, but one that actually cuts spending. If the Republicans hold the line, because they can control the budget, which requires a two-thirds vote, Democrats just can't pass it outright. They need some Republican votes to pass it as well. And if the Republicans hold firm, the Democrats will be forced to cave. Now, there were about 100 Republican amendments to the state budget introduced today on the state Senate floor, the upper house, and they were shot down on mostly a party-line vote. So I think the stalemate is going to continue for a while until somebody starts caving, but I hope it's the Democrats that start caving. We do not need more taxes on you and me and our family.
Well, I'll tell you what, though. I've been seeing these advertisements that are running on television, and it shows a little gray-haired lady sitting in obviously a nursing home, and the caption is, Denham or Senator McPherson, don't vote to cut the funding for this poor lady in a nursing home. Vote for responsible programs. And the general theme is, of course, to make the Republicans who are not going along with this massive tax increase, which is planned, the villains. And, of course, they are attacking your mother or grandmother or your great aunt who are in some sort of a government facility. So these are really very expensive advertisements, but they do have a certain emotional ring to them.
Well, they're not to be believed. There was a debate on the budget on the floor of the state assembly last week, and we had one legislator tell us that a Democrat member stood up and actually compared Republicans to Joseph Stalin, the mass murderer who ran the Soviet Union for many years. This Democrat claimed that murdering people by the thousands was easier than killing them one by one. You know, saying old people are going to die in the street, we're going to cut off dog food for disabled people, children are going to end up starving and ignorant. Assembly Speaker Herb Wesson actually said that Republicans would make children sick and throw dead foster kids' bodies on the street and help violent husbands continue to abuse their wives and kids rather than, quote, ask a millionaire to pay a penny more in taxes. Well, these horror stories don't get to much validation from the people. It's a field poll that we mentioned earlier is to be understood. Less and less people believe that taxes are justified to solve this budget mess. When the tax and spend politicians talk, less people believe them because they don't trust them.
All right. Well, that is certainly a very encouraging fact. Well, is there anything specific you'd like to bring up for our audience this evening? Is there anything you'd like them to do?
Well, yes. If you live in California, please call Governor Gray Davis. We've done so much work with our Campaign for California Families road tour, 23 news conferences, producing more than 60 media stories. I'm here in Los Angeles. There's going to be a four-minute story on the homosexual marriage bill in 2 days on two large TV stations down here. The word is getting out. These bills are being exposed. But you need to call yourself. You need to contact Governor Gray Davis and urge him to veto AB 205, the homosexual marriage bill, which is not marriage at all. And this bill, of course, reverses the vote of the people who want marriage protected for only a man and a woman. Please write down Governor Gray Davis's number. Even if you contacted him before, please contact him again. Send a strong message to veto AB 205. The governor's phone number is 916-445-2841. 916-445-2841. Of course, information on this bill, the governor's other phone numbers, and lots of action steps are for you. If your heart is concerned like mine is, take action and visit our website, SaveCalifornia.com. SaveCalifornia.com, easy to remember, easy to use.
All right, God bless you. Thanks so much, Randy.
Thank you for you, Dr.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, that was Randy Thomason, and hopefully very soon we're going to have on the line here Brad Dacus, and we're going to be talking about certainly what's going on in Sacramento in that area. As far as the legal situation, Brad Dacus, as you know, is with the Pacific Justice Institute, and by Jove, that looked like Brad Dacus. Brad, how are you?
Hey, you're doing just great.
Well, tell us what's going on the legal front.
We're really moving very aggressively on the RLUIPA issue, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. As many of your listeners will know, that's the federal statute that protects churches from unfair treatment by local governments. And we had a little bit of a setback a while back. But I'm pleased to announce that churches are still moving ahead. They're still using it. And the main thing I want them to realize is that it's still the law and for the rest of the country. It's just one little federal district down in L.A. That it's presently been suspended with. And we recently gave counsel to a church to move ahead. So I'm encouraging people to do that. And then, and also, once again, the legislature, the Senate right now is just moving on legislation and that could impact a lot of families. And like Randy, I'm just encouraging with the Justice Institute, encouraging people to really be involved and to get behind their legislators and especially these critical budget issues because there's some programs that are anti-family that we wouldn't mind seeing cut. And I think if Republicans stick to their guns, I think we could see some real healthy cuts.
In other words, you're cutting in government spending, and doing away with a lot of the useless programs that they have up there. But this is what you're suggesting?
Oh, absolutely. And some cuts don't feel good. Some cuts can hurt. But But programs that deal with funding some of these educational programs that are anti-family, that are invasive of the family. There's no reason, for example, for school districts to be paying millions of dollars for social reorientation for children to abandon that traditional marriage and buy for homosexuality. And we have many, many school districts in California using dollars, taxpayer dollars, to do that. And hopefully we'll be settling one of our cases against a school district like that. But, you know, that's going to end up costing them money because they didn't settle it initially. And that's ridiculous. It's a waste of resources. So hopefully school districts and others will learn that now is not the time to pour money into controversial programs that are going to cost them litigation, but instead to do the right thing and stick to their goal of academics.
Well, you know, the tragedy is, Brad, that there is an agenda there to corrupt the morality of our youth, and that's why they're spending all the money on the things that they're spending. You know, and our kids know a lot more about, you know, sodomy than they do about Shakespeare. You know, a lot more about global warming than they do about geography or geometry. And, of course, this is just totally morally wrong. They are using the educational system to reorient the children. They're not educating, they're indoctrinating them in the hedonist values, and it's about time parents understood that, and if they really care about their children, I don't see there's any way at all that they're going to be able to get a decent education and prepare themselves for the future in the current climate here in schools in California. Anything else you'd like to bring out? Maybe you get out your telephone number, your website?
Oh, you bet. I'd love to do that. Our telephone number is 888-305-9129, 888-305-9129, and our toll-free number, our webpage is pacificjustice.org, pacificjustice.org, and we're here to help people without charge. You should always feel free to contact us.
God bless you for everything you do. Bye-bye.
Thank Brad, you, Dr. Stanley.
Brad, we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, that's our report from the Sacramento. And, of course, this Religious Land Use Act, basically many of the city councils are filled with anti-Christian people who will do anything they can to block churches from being built or from using even the property that they bought and paid for. And, of course, because of this bigotry, fortunately, there is a piece of legislation, and I'm sure glad I wasn't in Washington, D.C., because I was probably voted against it on strictly constitutional principles. I don't think it's up to the federal government to have anything to do with local land use, but fortunately I wasn't back there. I didn't have to vote on it. And the legislation, even though I disagree with the philosophy of it, really has had the advantage of saying to local planning commissions and local city councils, you can't discriminate against churches just because you don't like Christians or you don't like Jews. And, of course, with that federal legislation to back them up, why an awful lot of churches have been able to do the building and the other things that were necessary. And, of course, we have our good friend Brad Dacus there defending those churches, and he's had excellent success. Well, let's get back with our good friend John Spring. John, why don't you pick up the discussion there of what's going on in Afghanistan, what's going on in the Caspian Basin, because that is really, for all intents and purposes, the center of the world today. And that at least is where the opening shots of World War III have already been fired. And of course, the average American is not being told we have no intention of pulling our troops out of the Middle East. They are there stationed permanently. Now, how can I say that? Well, I say that because the people who run our government say that. And you can go to their website, which is the newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org. That's that little group of people who back in 1997 began planning on how to take over America. And there were 25 of them, 11 from the CFR. They included Donald Rumsfeld, who's not necessarily a CFR member, but Dick Cheney and John Bolton, and Paul Wolfowitz, all of who are CFR, and even some of our major so-called religious leaders who are leading like the Pied Piper of Hamlet, the children of the Hamlet to their destruction. So many of our leaders are leading us in the wrong direction. They're not telling us. They're part of this little group that was, for all intents and purposes, at least initially, a conspiracy working in silent. Now, of course, they do have a website. But if you go to their report, Rebuilding America's Defenses, released a year before the September 11th attack, in September of the year 2000, they will tell you that their purpose is to keep American troops stationed in the Middle East. And this has nothing to do with Saddam Hussein. Their wording, and you'll find it in my March newsletter at RadioLiberty.com and the exact references to that, their wording was, of course, the necessity for American troops to be stationed in the Middle East transcends the regime of Saddam Hussein. Pull down my March newsletter at RadioLiberty.com. Understand, our troops are there more or less permanently in preparation for the war that is being planned, this prolonged Third World War. So pick up the story there, John.
Well, you've touched on many things. First of all, I did want to mention that the former king of Afghanistan, Mohammad Zahir Shah, may consider running, even at his very late age, he's in his mid-80s at least by now, for what would be the prime minister position in Afghanistan, because he's about the only one would be trusted by most of the people throughout Afghanistan. There isn't any other leader currently related to Afghanistan whom they would trust as well as they would the former king. Now, getting back to Iraq, and I'll certainly be glad to come back to Afghanistan on some other points, but what we fail to understand is the attempts by the British to colonize Iraq after the First World War. They attempted to put a king in power, and they attempted to establish a British type of government in that nation, but mainly as a colonial entity, a colony of the crown. But it became so expensive. They had to kill at least 100 dissidents a year back in the 20s just to maintain control of that nation. And it finally became such a high cost in terms of death tolls that they felt that it was counterproductive to hold on to it as a colony any longer. And so then they transferred power to one of their favorable contacts who became its king and attempted to rule until a coup d'etat came about roughly during the 1950s. And what we need to understand is that we will probably be losing more American men and women within the next 6 months after the so-called victory of Baghdad than we did during the entire invasion of Iraq to begin with. There will be a few killed every day here and there, but when it comes to doing the math, we will have more casualties, more deaths, more serious injuries as a result of the indiscriminate shooting that is currently going on throughout Iraq at this time. And that's tragic, Dr. Stan.
It really is. And, you know, of course, the thing is that there are people there who hate America. And, of course, Al-Qaeda is organizing cells there. You know, this is a wonderful place to attack America. And, of course, then I'm sure there are followers of Saddam Hussein, the Ba'athist Party. And, of course, they have been, of course, in a very favored position under the Saddam regime that, incidentally, we financed and backed all during the 1980s. And, of course, for the skeptic there, there's a wonderful book. It's called Unholy Babylon. It was written over a decade ago, pointing out that Saddam Hussein was part of a CIA hit squad or assassination squad in the 1950s. Gee, I wonder, and there are many, many people who say that he continued working with the CIA after that. At first, this article in the book said, well, a lot of the people in the Ba'ath Party said that wasn't true. But then that's very hard to admit that the possibility that your leader was actually working for the CIA. Be that as it may, why, of course, we have, of course, the Ba'ath Party are very unhappy with what's happening because they no longer, of course, getting all the goodies, being able to dominate the Shias and the Christians and the Kurds, and so they're certainly a part of this guerrilla warfare, aren't they?
Yes, and to be honest, there's so much propaganda going on throughout the Middle East through Arab TV to a large extent, which strongly suggests that Saddam Hussein may return to power at a later date, and those citizens of Iraq who are aiding or assisting the American forces will be dealt with severely at a later date. And from past experiences, there's a certain amount of credibility in terms of the harm that will be inflicted upon them if indeed there's any truth to such rumors.
Well, of course, the fear that Saddam is still alive and could come back would, of course, discourage many, many people from wanting to do anything as far as helping to restore order in that area, because these people will all be tortured and killed. But, of course, why would we ever have backed a man who tortured and killed his opponents, as we did all during the 1980s when we financed Saddam's war with Iran? And, you know, that is the question I think every American should ask. You know, can we compromise our principles and support evil with the idea we're doing good, or creating a balance of power, or are we responsible when our government does this sort of thing? And what is our moral responsibility for the fact that the CIA works with ruthless killers throughout the world?
Yes, and going back to Afghanistan for just a second, this is exactly what has been occurring with the agreements that we have established with the so-called Northern Alliance or United Front. We basically are supporting thugs who are very ruthless, who are not playing by any type of fair play rules whatsoever, and we have supported them, I guess, blindly, although it's hard for us to believe that our U.S. forces deployed over there can be also turning their heads the other way while all of these atrocities are being committed. They must either be participants themselves or certainly aware of what is going on, I would think.
Well, of course, when you're in special forces, you do what you're told, and you don't question orders, you don't question what's going on. You are employed for a specific purpose, for specific operations. That's why they call them SOG, Specific Operation Groups, or Special Operations Groups. So
yes.
They are simply pawns in this whole violent game of murder that is being carried out, and assassination, and of course intrigue in the mysterious Middle East. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. Those of you who haven't read the book Expendable Elite by Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, who was part of the special operations, and of course his being recruited as a professional assassin. Of course, he was doing this for his country. He really believed that the people he was to kill and did kill were, of course, enemies of his country, of course, until he became a Christian. Then he realized, of course, that much of what he had done had been entirely wrong. Expendable Elite by Daniel Marvin, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, a fascinating, fascinating book written by a very, very brave man. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to give us a call, again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, and we'll take your call right after the break. Go ahead there, John. We've got about a minute before we go to the break.
Well, I just thought I would mention very briefly, if it's all right with you, Dr. Stan, the radio program that I have here in Southern California called Sound Off with John W. Spring that airs every Sunday night at 9 p.m. on KPLS, which is 8:30 on the AM dial. And we attempt to deal with topics very similar to what we're discussing right now. We had an Afghan guest whose identity had to be kept anonymous on our last week's program. And we deal with health issues and...
How is the program coming? Is it, maintaining itself?
Financially, we're still rather weak, but our audience has grown considerably. Far more rapidly than what I had expected at this stage.
Well, I'm glad for that. We'll be back in just a moment with John Spring, who has his own program in Southern California, there on a regular basis. We'll be right back with John Spring. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, John Spring. We're talking about, of course, the Middle East, and John is a geographer, and he studies the issues, the personalities, and so he certainly has a great wealth of information. Now, if you agree or disagree, give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Go ahead, pick up your story there, John.
Well, let me just say one thing about geography. Most Americans, unfortunately, were never blessed with the opportunity that I had received in terms of understanding geography of America and the rest of the world, for that matter. Because in our system, the Carnegie Endowment made sure to have control of the aspects of education that dealt with foreign policies and international affairs, basically. And so those were the two areas, including national security, that were more or less off limits to other foundations in terms of building up the curricula. So as a result, generations have gone by without any substantial geographic education here in America, while by contrast, most of the Marxist nations, such as the former Soviet Union and mainland China today, consider geography a very prestigious discipline within their academia. And without an in-depth understanding of geography, most Americans do not have the analytical tools to always discern what is really going on. We have an entire body of Congress, both the House and Senate, which for the most part have members that are completely ignorant of any geographical concepts. And as a result, their leadership is somewhat dwarfed in terms of when it comes to decision making. I happened to be in the U.S. Senate at the time when they gave carte blanche to the Diem regime in South Vietnam without any knowledge about that nation. The same has been true on practically every American policy since the Eisenhower administration, basically, that I've, as an adult, have had a chance to learn something about. And it's tragic when you consider that practically every policy or move that is made by the United States government, there is very little substantial study, very few cases in which officials do their homework in depth to preclude the possibilities of getting in over their head or making tragic mistakes, as is so often the case. And
well, of course, they countered the tragic mistake in Vietnam with the Diem regime by killing Mr. Diem and Mr. Nu, and that's covered in a book called Double Cross, written, of course, by Chuck Giancano, Sam Giancano's brother, Sam Giancano being the head of the mafia, and Chuck being his brother. So we took care of course, the assassination of the people we put in power, which should be a good lesson, of course, to anybody who deals with the Central Intelligence Agency. Why, in fact, even Sam Giancano himself was assassinated shortly before he was being called before the Church Committee to testify about the relationship between the Mafia and the Central Intelligence Agency. Gee, I wonder who did Sam Giancana win. Let's go to Eric, who's calling from Compton. Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. How about you?
Oh, we're doing great. Good to hear from you.
Mr. Spring.
Yes.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I've got a question for you. Quick comment. I've been at this stuff now for maybe about 11 years. When I first got introduced on a radio station down here, KPFK.
Yes.
Listening to Lieutenant Colonel Bull Gripe.
Yes.
And subsequently I found out that that radio station is owned by the left. That's another story.
Yes.
Anyway, the question was, whatever happened to Colonel, to the Lieutenant Colonel? I lost track of him.
I honestly...
Did you know him?
I have never had the pleasure of meeting him. I knew that he was a fine patriot, or at least I believed him to be. I know that he went on missions trying to relocate MIAs
right.
Who were left behind in Southeast Asia. But to
he
be
actually
honest,
found some, too.
Say again, I'm sorry.
He actually found, as a matter of fact, that's where he got the story Rambo from. He actually found some, and somebody dropped a dime on him, and a gunboat came around the corner and shot them all up. He barely got out alive. That's where he got the idea from Rambo. Or Rambo movie.
That's really very true, Eric. Well, basically, he has retired from from his activities on the shortwave, and he's had some personal tragedies. His marriage broke up, and so he's sort of dropped out. He's engaging in business activities, but he's certainly not actively involved in the Patriot movement at the present time. Any other question, Eric?
No, I'll just keep listening, Doc.
All right, it's good to know that you're down there in Compton. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
And look, Eric, your job is to get other people listening to our internet programs and shortwave and satellite programs, but you know how to get them.
Believe me.
Yes, and Eric, please,
number one job.
Eric, while I have you on the line, please try to pick us up every Sunday night on KPLS, which is 8:30 on the AM dial at 9 p.m. every Sunday evening.
Give me the call letters again.
KPLS.
And what's the
numbers? Yeah.
The number is 830. Just about the middle of your AM.
Oh, okay. Oh, you know what? That's where I found Bob Morey, and that's where I found George Putnam also just a couple of weeks ago. He's back
same
in the radio
station.
8:30. 9 o'clock. Sunday night.
9 p.m. every Sunday night.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks. Good night, Eric.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, of course, that's Eric calling from Compton. He's one of our regular listeners. And, again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. If you have a question for John Spring as we talk about, of course, what's going on in the Middle East today and really the great tragedy of Afghanistan involved in war for almost a quarter of a century, and, of course, little stability there at the present time. So why don't you pick up the story from there, John, as far as what's really going on over there?
Well, first of all, to give you an idea of the size of Afghanistan, it's just a little smaller than the state of Texas. And there is no accurate census of Afghanistan's population, but it is estimated to be between 21 and 25 million. I think the 25 million figure is probably closer to being correct with the recent influx of several million refugees returning from neighboring Iran and Pakistan into their homeland.
And these are people, of course, escaped from that area because of the persistent wars, and they felt it was better even to be a refugee than to be in the middle of the bombing and the firefights and the chaos that that goes with remaining in a war zone.
Well, you have to understand, during the Afghan War, the war with the former Soviet Union, entire villages were just obliterated from the map. There were many atrocities, and of course, none of these were ever reported in the newspapers or on TV because, to be quite honest, we just did not have access.
Well, but now, who was in charge? Who was responsible for obliterating the villages? Was that the Russians?
Yes.
Well, of course, our good friend Gorbachev was in charge of the Russian army during a good deal of that war. Are you suggesting that Gorbachev might be guilty of war crimes in the same way that Milosevic would be guilty of war crimes?
Even more so, Dr. Stan. In fact, even if Gorbachev had remained in power, there's no way that he would have allowed the Baltic states to become separate entities unto themselves. Gorbachev is not the moderate that we portray him as, just as the Gorbachev Foundation is just not one little office at the Presidio office of the former Sixth Army in San Francisco, but rather it is a facility in Moscow which is comparable to 1 kilometer, square kilometer in size, and has a staff at least comparable to that of the personnel in our Pentagon.
Gee, I wonder who's paying for all of that. Well, maybe it's his good friend Stephen Rockefeller, or his good friend Marie Strong, or maybe the Rockefellers themselves. Who knows? Well,
several Fortune 500 companies, I'm sure of that.
I'm sure that that's true, and we've got Rose called. Is that Rose from New York? Hi, Rose.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good Haven't heard from you in some time. How are things back in New York?
Okay.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, I have a letter. I don't know if you ever heard of the Sierra Times. It's an online newspaper. Okay, they have an article, and it's from the soldiers of the 2nd Brigade, 3rd Infantry. They're in Iraq now. They claim to have been the first forces on March 20th for the daring strike in Baghdad. They keep being told they're going to be sent home, and they're not. And The other says here that his men have diarrhea. They haven't had fresh fruits, vegetables. They need clean uniforms. They need the everyday stuff. It says, for the past 9 months, we've lived a hard life. We trained for nearly 6 months before the war started. He says, our men and women completed every mission. I'm trying to get, oh, here. Our morale is not high or even low. It's non-existent. We've been told twice that we're going home, and twice we've been received a stop movement to stay in Iraq. Skipping, every single one of my men has diarrhea because none of us on the front lines have had a single fresh vegetable in over a month. They feel betrayed and forgotten. I'm just scanning, you know, the article.
Now, when was this article posted, Deborah?
I just took it today. I found it. At the bottom it says that this letter was July 1st. It says this letter was written on the 1st of July. Since that time, they were given instructions July 8th that they were to pack and return for Fort Stewart by August 1st, 2003. On July 12th, that order was rescinded, and they were told they were extended in Iraq until September 30th or the earliest, at the earliest.
Well,
okay.
It's a tragic situation, Rose, and our boys are over there. They're really expendable. That's the tragedy. It's just like the boys we abandoned after the Second World War and after the Korean War, 8,000 after the Korean War, 20 to 25,000 after the Second World War, and nobody ever cares. They really don't.
And the
American people really are concerned about our fighting men. And, quit waving the flag and say, we want our boys, of course, we want them home, we want them backing. If they're going to have to go into battle, we want them to be allowed to win. But not, certainly we got in into Baghdad, but the Iraqis let us into Baghdad. They did not defend the area. They did not use their planes. What about the 150 fighter planes they had? Did you see any pictures of the Iraqi planes? What were they saving for them, the next war? What about their helicopters? Why weren't they using their surface-to-air missiles against our helicopters? Now, why did they send the Republican Guard, many of them willing to fight and die for their country? Why did they disband them? Nothing, as it appears to be. Obviously, Donald Rumsfeld knew what was going to happen, and none of our military knew. And you can only ask, how can Donald Rumsfeld be so much smarter than all of his generals, all of our generals?
Dr. Stan? He makes a comment here. He says, we also read the letters that our commanding general, M.G. Buford Blount, writes in our local newspaper. Each time we read his words, our desperation grows deeper because we know that most of our countrymen are hearing his lies about our situation here.
Well, they just are not getting the supplies they need.
Not at all.
Well, I just hope and pray that that's not true. But all we can do is just say that this is a report from supposedly from our men there, and let's keep an eye on it, that website, and let us know. I know the Sierra Times does a very, very good job.
Yeah.
The information you're not going to get from Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, or Barbara Walters.
Well,
I would suggest someone, anybody might want to go and read it. It's Sad Soldiers, and there's a lot in there.
Okay, fine. John, do you have any comment at all?
Yes. While we have our caller still on the line, I would just like to say I have heard even on the major news media a very similar story that these troops that were deployed early in Iraq are going to be kept there almost indefinitely for quite some time. This is very disheartening news, and so at least some of this information is being carried now by the news media at this particular time. I've heard this here, at least in the Southern California area.
But I think the saddest thing is, of course, that the American people have not been told that we intended to station troops permanently in the Middle East. The PNAC group wrote about it in their Rebuilding America's Defenses report up on the web at newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org, Rebuilding America's Defenses. You can pull down my March newsletter, radio newsletter for this year. It'll give you all the references to where to look in that report and find out that we plan to leave our troops there indefinitely, but we don't want to tell the American people that. We don't want to tell them that we are in World War III.
Yes.
They might, of course, begin to react and ask, what's this really all about?
In reality, the only two possible ways for a GI over there to return at this time would be either in a body bag or so severely wounded or injured that they would have to be evacuated from the
What a great tragedy. And, of course, we want to stand behind our men. They're American boys who went overseas thinking they were fighting for America. After all, we had to stop the wicked Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction, which could be unleashed on America at any moment.
Dr. Stan,
yes.
They even have here, it says they are in need of uniforms, which the Army continues to promise to replace, along with boots and fresh food, and they're not getting any of these.
Well, I hope and pray that that is not true, but that it, you know, it certainly is a very, very shocking statement, and I would hope that if anybody out there has any direct information or contact directly with these boys, please let us know. I'd like to know if this is maybe planted by the enemy's administration or if this indeed is what's really going on. Could it be that they... Because, you know, I've been in the military, and I know they always... The one thing they always did was feed us pretty well. I find it difficult to believe they can't get fresh food over there, or they could buy it in the economy, but only time is going to tell. Anything else, Rose?
No, that's it. When I read this, I was kind of upset, and I thought, well, your program would at least let others know about it.
I think so. Now, I remember, we don't know that it's accurate, but it is a shocking thing, and it may very well be. All we can do is try to get information from every place that we can, and so all we can do is give you the opportunity to get the information out. And so if you're out there in the listening audience, you have any information for or against this, please let us know.
He says, we are also the unit that is sitting in the city of Al-Fallujah, Fallujah.
Do you know anything about that, John?
I'm just guessing that it's northeast of Baghdad, about 60 kilometers, but that's just a rough guess on my mind. I don't have a map in front of me. And that is an area that was fairly much sympathetic towards Saddam Hussein in the past. But I'm not positive of that. I'm unprepared to really give an intelligent guess on that. That's just a very rough guess.
Okay, fine. Anything else, Rose?
No, that's it.
God
thank
bless
you.
Good night. Good to hear from you.
Okay, thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
All right, fine. Well, I hope that that's not accurate, but heaven only knows. Certainly sometimes you will get information this way that is what you're not getting through the controlled media. But anyway, the one thing is certainly for sure, and that is they keep promising to bring all of our boys home. We're only going to be there. It's going to be a brief battle. We're going to win the war. We're going to restore democracy. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that was never the plan. The plan was permanently to station troops there in the Middle East, and they're not coming home, no matter what they keep saying. And of course, they may rotate them, some of them, home, but they'll put other troops there because we want a constant military presence in the Middle East. And just as we're developing a military presence in Eastern Europe now and moving troops into Poland, why are we moving troops into Poland? Why are we, moving our troops all throughout the world? And yet we can't defend the borders, the southern borders of our own country? What's wrong with this picture? Well, you must understand the real agenda is a world empire. Eventually, of course, this new world order and new world religion. But we have to destroy all the Islamic countries that don't want to go along with a world government, that don't want to relinquish their sovereignty and simply replace their leaders with people who will go along with the new world order, the new world religion.
Yes, and Dr. Stan, we have to remember that we still have troops in Bosnia and Herzegovina and Kosovo and 100 other regions of the world, for that matter. As you said, our borders are wide open. People are coming in so rapidly that there's no way that they're going to assimilate into the United States as American citizens at the rate things are going. So we are not looking out for our best interests, possibly the interests of some multinational corporation or a conglomerate thereof, but we have to be concerned. This is not a question as to whether you're a conservative or a liberal or a Democrat or Republican or some other constitutional independent party, but we need to be concerned about America at this time. And unfortunately, we're about the only faction that seems to be concerned at this time. It's a very sad situation, and I hope all of the listening audience understands the need for communicating with Washington while we can still have that privilege of communicating. And we have to educate our leaders, because they are, for the most part, ignorant of these situations. So we have to construct instructive letters so that they fully understand the dilemma in many instances. In some cases, they have been bought off, unfortunately, by special interest groups and lobbyists. So we have our work cut out for us. This is not the time when we can relax at all, and I just hope and pray that by this time next year that you and yours truly will still be able to be on the air, because our liberties, especially our individual rights, are being eroding away at a very rapid rate. And I just hope that we can at least be able to communicate. It's an alarming situation, Dr. Stan.
Well, I'm really so pleased that you're down there and you've got that video program, and of course you're reaching out to the people there on every Sunday evening, and that's so important. And the more people that are getting the information out, the better it will be.
Yes, there have to be many different sources. One source will not do it for everyone, unfortunately, and I realize everyone does not share my philosophy or your philosophy completely, but I would encourage everyone to support your program, because you have certainly been informing the American public as to what is going on, and they need to become aware. This isn't something just fabricated. This is something that every American needs to become informed about. They need to study it more in depth, and they need to share that information with their friends. And we can go on the air and we can give an in-depth analysis of a situation, but unless the listening audience understands the significance of that, we're just talking to ourselves, I suppose.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about the Caspian Basin oil. Now, of course, initially when there was found to be oil in the Caspian Basin, there was a large Argentinian firm that went in and began to negotiate treaties and agreements with the, I think it was, is that Kazakhstan or Kazakhstan? It was right adjacent to the Caspian Sea.
Kazakhstan. And also Turkmenistan to the south.
All right, fine. And of course, we weren't about, of course, the Union Oil Company, Unocal, wasn't about to let that happen. And because of their strong relationships with our government, why then we began, of course, to undercut the Argentinians and their agreements. And then, of course, you know, so the Argentinians are pretty well frozen out of this. And then, of course, American corporations, several American major American oil companies now have the leases on the drilling rights in the Caspian Sea and adjacent to that. Is that pretty accurate at the present time? Do the Argentinians still have any representation over there?
I think they have some, Dr. Stan, but it's very negligible at this time. Another thing that we fail to understand is that during the Clinton administration, the Department of Commerce had basically established its own miniature State Department with authority almost on par with the Department of State for authorizing various types of grants. And we forget that former Secretary of Congress, Commerce, I should say, Ron Brown, had many missions to the Caspian Aral region. And it's believed that that's where he was headed on the last ill-fated mission that he was on, which is very questionable even to this day. Many companies would pay large sums of money to go aboard these special aircraft with VIPs such as former Secretary of Commerce Ron Brown and others. The Caspian Sea region is very rich in both natural gas and petroleum. As I said earlier, the reserves, conservatively speaking, are comparable to those of Kuwait, which is probably the second largest oil-producing nation in the world at this time, next to, of course, Saudi Arabia. Not too far behind, of course, is Iran.
Well, now, how about Iraq? My understanding is that they've got tremendous oil, deposits if properly developed. Is that true?
That is also true. enough to worry Saudi Arabia, because if Iraq was controlled by the U.S., it would not necessarily become a member of OPEC. And the same is true, by the way, with the Caspian Aral region. Most of those areas would not be under the control of OPEC as well. So the United States and some other countries are very motivated to establish those pipelines, get them operating, because here are different sources which would not be obligated to go by with the guidelines of OPEC. And
well, of course, if we could control that oil, then we could control the world price of oil and bring it down to $12, $15 a barrel, which would be a tremendous stimulus to our economy and, of course, would end up destabilizing Saudi Arabia. And if we really want to, of course, do away with a major source of funding for Al-Qaeda, we're going to have to get rid of Saudi Arabia, or at least their current policies. They're not about to stop funding Al-Qaeda and this terrorist movement because it is based in Wahhabism, which is the official religion of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
If they don't and if they don't support it, why, they're going to lose the support of their clerics, and then, of course, the House of Saud falls. So the only way we're going to stop the funding of all of Al-Qaeda at any time in the foreseeable future is to do away with the current government of Saudi Arabia. They're not going to voluntarily stop funding Al-Qaeda. They funded before 9/11. They funded 9/11, and certainly we know that 15 of the 19 terrorists were from Saudi Arabia. And so is Osama bin Laden. What does that suggest to there? But the other interesting thing is that our State Department made sure that those people could come into this country without any adequate screening. And there was no requirement that they have interviews before they came or any reason for them to come here. It was almost as if our State Department was inviting the Islamic terrorists from Saudi Arabia to come here and attack our country. Well, we're just about out of time. John, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, very briefly, regarding Saudi Arabia, this is one of the most absolute monarchies in the world, with very little, if any, freedoms for its subjects. So the United States is continuing to support tyrants, basically, throughout a good share of the Middle East. And I think we need to make the American people aware of whom we are really supporting and at what cost. American lives are being lost because we're supporting tyrants in Afghanistan. Currently, lives are being lost because we don't have an adequate policy regarding Iraq. So the American people need to wake up, and they need to contact their congressmen and educate them on how serious this whole situation is, because we cannot continue in this dismal situation.
Amen to that. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Our guest has been John Spring. God bless you. Thanks for being with us, John.
The Lord bless you, Dr. Stan, and thank you for having me on your program.
Bye-bye. Oh, this is Dr. Stan. And, of course, we ask you to pray for America and to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be back at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night. And no, actually, it'll be Thursday evening. Tomorrow is my evening off. Thursday, Dr. Stan, good night. And may the Lord be with you.